Blog Talk Radio.
Special episode of Kentuckiana Grassroots Radio. I've been taking some vital time to go through an apologetic series of defending Christianity and the Christian faith, because at this time in our nation's history, the very basic foundations of our culture and of our Constitution are at stake. Our very lives are at stake in many cases. And on one level, there are many people who would say, well, I'm not really in any danger. And yet, the problem is they're not looking at all the graves that already were in danger and already are dead now. Fact is that, you know, on one level, I've kind of called this the soft Civil War, and I think Dennis Prager took up that title as well. And basically, it is not soft for some people. We have created cultures of death. There was a shooting in Texas today. Is of this time, I've been busy with work and other projects, so I've only heard about it. I haven't heard how many people were killed. But this is all a process. This is all a part of a larger system. And even conservative thinkers and people don't get the full picture. And there is a lot of explanation as far as why that is, but basically, as we have fallen down this rabbit hole into communism, as other nations have in the past, even those people who are, quote, on the right, are no longer really on the right. They're really in the middle, and they don't have a full understanding of how this stuff works and how it's going on. So basically, this follows a train of logic, so you really need to look at the first couple episodes where I've done this. One is talking about, I believe it was called The Reasons in Faith, and why we should presuppose that God exists as opposed to presupposing God does not exist. Okay. And there are positive evidences and things of that nature that deal with God and God's existence. But there is something that we have to just presuppose in order to. And so basically I give the reasonings why that is, why it is necessary. Some arguments are good, but they're not necessary. The cosmological argument that usually starts with the Big Bang is one that's what we call reasonable, and some people agree to it and some people don't. But it's not an essential argument. But basically, I went through that first one talking about the need for that, where materialism fails, atheism fails to positively produce any knowledge that there is no God or there is no infinity or divine. And by the way, a lot of atheists are unaware of that. They're unaware that the concept of infinity really destroys their basic concepts of materialism. And they might not even be aware that they need to be materialist. If they're not materialist, then how can they be naturalist? Well, anyhow, so we go through that first one. Then I dealt with an episode called Extinct, where Darwinian evolution has failed. And it didn't just fail recently. It's been long dead since I was a toddler. And yet there has been a lot of cover-up behind that. There is some word that's gotten out over the years, but they do what they can to keep it out of mainstream consciousness. And since it does not fundamentally work, it needs, for instance, it needs the doctrine of spontaneous generation of life. Even if you want to say, well, maybe it was an alien that started life on Earth, you have to have a spontaneous generation of life of the alien. You can't escape that. So once we get to realize those fundamentals are gone from the evolutionary worldview, that they're impossible, then everything that follows it is also impossible, or at least anecdotal. Now, anecdotes are things that give you evidence, but they don't prove something. Okay, so in other words, you see something happen over and over again, then you say, okay, well, this is the way it has to be. And yet, it doesn't have to be. What you've developed is, by anecdotal evidence, you develop a superstition. Okay, well, this is the way it's worked before, so that, therefore it always works. That's a superstition. You know, you have your lucky rabbit's foot, and as long as you kiss your lucky rabbit's foot, you'll win the football game. Well, you might have won some football games, but you have an anecdote, and you have a superstition. So, basically, we went through there, and then we talked about the gospel itself and gave proof of the resurrection of Christ. And then we dealt with Bible prophecy and the supernatural nature of the Bible, along with the doctrine of inerrancy, and how is the Bible to be the ultimate source of authority of truth. So now we have to ask ourselves, what is man? In order to deal with our worldview and deal with the other worldviews of others, you have to know who you're dealing with. What are you as a man? What are you as a human being? A biblical worldview, I would say, this is mankind. In a humanist worldview, this is a human. The human is a mammal. The mammal is a product of other mammals in an evolutionary chain. The man is ultimately only material. That worldview has been debunked. They do not have any fossil evidence of that. They do not have any inheritance of that. They have not proven things genetically. Basically, that was a fallacy that's very popular. And so, what is man? When Ronald Reagan was giving a speech for the presidential campaign of Barry Goldwater, he pointed out a socialist from Pennsylvania and said that he was offended at socialists because he called the citizens the masses. He says, we are not the masses. We are constitutional republic. We have a intrinsic worth and value. Man has an intrinsic worth and value. If he is mankind, if he's just a human, then he does not have that same value. He is only material that just happened to evolve into a superior state if you are objectively saying what superior even is to begin with, because everything will break down into relativism. Now, when we look at creation, the creation story of Genesis is not mythology. Number one, we've already given the assertion that the Bible is a spiritual book because it's shown it in the power of prophecy. We've shown a philosophy where if this is God's word and how God's word kind of interconnects itself as a body of literature, that it is one body of literature, even though it's written by many authors, showing that its one true author is God, that it is objective. And there is no other objective authority to topple it. Humanists will admit that they are not objective, so that they cannot objectively topple the truth of Revelation. The best they can hope for is that it will contradict itself. Now, when we deal with the creation, we are dealing with historical fact. Genesis is a historical narrative, and I have a blog article which really kind of goes over that. Hebraist James Barr, for instance, says that nobody that he knew in his academic community understood Genesis to be anything else but intending to convey the six-day creation of the world. He did not believe that at all, but he knew that's what the text was saying. The hermeneutics is sound. It is a historical narrative, not an allegory or poem or something of that nature. Certain literary genres, there are certain hermeneutical rules that would state that when it's using these facts and figures and dates and times, that it is historical. And it intends to be historical. You could say that it's fiction. That's another argument. If it is revelation, then the fiction clause would not be there. But two guys that I always propose when we discuss this is Josephus, the Jewish historian, as well as Archbishop James Usher. Both of them were world-class historians in the art of history. And both of them understood that Genesis was intended, especially Genesis 1, that Genesis was intended as historical narrative and historical facts. And so when they wrote their histories, that's what they wrote. So now that we see, okay, this is revelation because of the prophecy. This is part of the canon. Now we look at the story, and we have the story of Adam and Eve. We know that evolution is not possible, molecules to man, and, you know, man coming from the ape. But actually, hold on, modern science has given up on man coming from an ape. The population of human beings, mankind, is supposedly based on a hybrid species which has never been found in any archaeological dig, okay, or geological dig, paleontological dig. They just haven't dug it up. So, essentially, what the claim has changed. Darwin said that we came from the orangutan. Others like to say we came from the chimp. But no. Our population of 8 billion people descended from something that doesn't even have evidence of the existence. And, of course, they have no prediction on exactly what this primate looks like. And, of course, we have a record of years of frauds. Top-down man, G-man, Encino man, that's kind of a joke. But basically, they have falsified information repeatedly. Even the Lucy fossil has different, so here, when you look at the Lucy fossil, you go to the museum, like the Museum of St. Louis, they have a full-body picture. But Lucy had no feet. All of Lucy's bones, I think except for the knee, was normal ape. Not designed for walking as an erect human. And yet, they draw Lucy with human feet. Why? There is no fossil with human feet. There is a bone that was claimed to be part of Lucy. It turned out to be, I think it was hundreds of feet away. If I'm wrong, it's still long distance. And so basically, these claims have no substance, they have no reality, they have no fact, they have no observation. And yet we do have observation. We have history. Adam, Eve, and that cast of characters. And the difficulty bringing this out is the fact that the Bible's history has a series of genealogies, chapters, and stories. And then it has the story of the Great Flood. So we're occupying about 1,000 years of time. And then there is the Tower of Babel, and then all the other civilizations pop up after that. So these civilizations, when they write their chronology, do not write about a Great Flood, because that was before their civilization ever existed. But even though they don't write as chronology, they have it as a tale. You have around, I've heard as big as 600 flood myths. And some of these are almost nearly identical, and some of these are, you know, just barely touching it. But there is stories of the flood, whether you are dealing with tribes from South America, China, Australia, Europe, Arabia, Africa. There's all these legends of the flood. And so we have this history backing us. When we look at the ancient Greeks, there are stories that match Bible stories. The Greeks have an idea called the Golden Age. And in the Golden Age, they have people that are multiple centuries old, just like the Genesis genealogies before the flood. And then afterwards, there is a slow downward spiral of ages. Moses ended up living 130 years. I'd like to say that Abraham lived a little over 200 years, but I'd have to go back and look. And then you have Noah being 950 years old, but he was 600 years old when he went out with the ark. And many of the people who were his descendants died before he died. Why were these ages so advanced before the flood, and why were they descending downward to where we have the same life expectancy that we have today? The naturalistic worldview assumes that everything that's going on now has always gone on. But this is a logical fallacy. It's called the fallacy of inductive logic. If you have not observed it, then you cannot prove that it always has been the same. And so the biblical story tells us something of a scientific philosophy we call catastrophism, that there was something better in the origins of the earth, in the origins of life, and that it's descended since, that it has fallen apart, and that great catastrophes has caused it to do this. Meanwhile, you have another principle, uniformitarianism, where things are supposed to be the same. And the only thing to explain away what we observe is time. And so, oh, this looks older, so it must be older. Why? Because it's worn down and beat up. You know, I saw someone a couple months ago, and they had been my age, and they looked like they were 60, because of basically a lot of drug abuse. And what's going on? They have had calamity in their life, and it's worn them down. And so the earth went through catastrophes and got worn down, and they look old. But when we go all the way back in time to Adam and Eve, we have Eden, the paradise. And the paradise was starting off with a physically perfect man. And from the physically perfect man, we get his wife. Now, this is one of those deals where you do have to understand God, Bible prophecy, miracles. We are in a supernatural state. But once you get that, then obviously the all-powerful God created man and he decided to create woman from the man. Very interesting. Because the natural is for the woman to be the source with the help of man. But this was not natural. This is beginning nature. It's not under nature. And we cannot understand that unless we understand there is something more to nature. But that is the foundation. Now, woman. You see, when we deal with the feminist revolution, we think men and women are equal because they're all material. Not only are men and women equal, they are neutral, and animals have the same place that they do. In fact, even a rock has the same rights, ultimately, because there is nothing intrinsic to give them value. And so it's always assumed that men and women are psychological equivalents. That one has, you know, their body parts and one has the other one. That, you know, except for those big organ differences, they're exactly the same. But this is just, and I remember about a decade ago, there was a president of Harvard University. I believe his last name was Summers, but I could be wrong. And he was a liberal, big shock, Harvard University. But this Harvard University president cited peer-reviewed doctrinal data to show that the brains and the minds of men and women are not the same, that they are different. They are different brains, different minds, chemical reactions. And he cited scientific data. And I think he was probably incited. I think he just said it offhand, and then he had to go and show some research. But nevertheless, he was shamed out of the university because the university had been taken over by an agenda. And so it didn't matter what the facts were. It just mattered that we have to have equality at all times. But the only number that is perfect in equality is the number zero. Desolation is the ultimate equation. Now, if you understand creation, then you have man who is in the image of God. The image of God is several theologians have said different things, but I would basically say that the image of God, man being in that image, is a reflection of God's attributes. Because the image is a bearing of light. In John 1, it says that Jesus is the light of the world, while it also says in Colossians that he's the image of the invisible God. And so man reflects the nature of God. Does he still today? I believe that he's created with that divine spark, but that there is darkness of the human soul that develops over time with the cause of sin. So I believe that, you know, if you look at a baby, there's something that just naturally, you know, especially let's say you put a baby in front of either family or you put the baby in front of women, but maybe also children too. And what's the first thing they say when they see a baby? Oh, there is just a natural psychological reaction every time upon the sight of a little baby. Man reflects these divine attributes. Now, you go in the opposite in the natural world, and the baby is now a fetus. Now, the word fetus is Latin for infant. It's just a foreign name to confuse people who do not speak Latin. But the baby is a fetus with fetal tissue, and then it gets born. And it does not have an identity until it can assert its own identity existentially. And before that, it is only the material property of the parent, specifically the mother. Now, the mother has most of the biological material that creates the baby. But what the man contributes, we call it sperm. In the Old Testament, it's called seed, is the DNA which will program the egg. And so it will give it an idea, a function, a shape, and a value. In Zechariah chapter 12, it says that God puts the spirit into man at birth. So they form the spirit within them. In Genesis 2, verse 7, when it talks about the creation of Adam, it says that he breathed into him the breath of life, and the man became a living soul. And by the way, I'm quoting memory. I'm not really looking at the Bible quote, but, you know, when we get specific, I always go back to King James. But anyhow, the Christians in general have different views of the composition of man. Adam, some word pictures would talk about red dirt, but it's also Hebrew man. And what is the female, the woman, from the womb, from the man? Okay? This is that starting point. And what is it? It's that idea. And when we look at Christ, John 1:14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The Word, the Logos, the logic, the idea. There is some immaterial, there's an immaterial starting point behind what we call a human. Whereas human and Homo sapien, these are all biological reference frames. So the ultimate identity is materialistic versus the ultimate identity being spiritual. But there is debate within Christendom. And I don't put a lot of weight in that. I put my weight in the Bible, and let it define words, let it define truth, let it define reality, because the Bible is revealed revelation, that is divine knowledge. So it doesn't matter to me if somebody calls themselves Christian and disagrees. But essentially, to let you know, the majority of people argue what I would call the Catholic view of humanity. That is, that man has a physical body and an immaterial soul. And that the phrase, or the word soul and the word spirit are identical. In other circles, more Judaized circles, like the most famous with the Seventh-day Adventists and Jehovah's Witnesses, man is the soul and the spirit, and they're both the material, physical, human body. And so when you die, you sleep. And then one day you'll be physically resurrected, but there is no immaterial realm. And it's just something that's very much refuted in Scripture.
Jews, by the way, do not have to be so materialistic, however. I think they really kind of inherited that from the ancient fantasies, which is sad. But basically, there are Jews who believe in a spiritual realm and a spiritual soul. Dennis Prager was probably the most popular one that I've heard, who believes that we have a spiritual essence. But biblically, I believe it's neither one part or two parts, but three parts. That man has a spirit and a soul and the flesh. And that flesh includes our physical brain with all of its chemical hormones. Meanwhile, we have this immaterial spirit. And the etymology, which is the symbols that are brought in with that word for spirit, ruach in the Hebrew and pneuma in the Greek, you have breath and blood and activity and basically life. So the spirit is the force of life, the breath in man. Meanwhile, you have the psyche, the mind, the soul. Freud also has a trichotomy, the id or ego, and the superego. I think that's it. Remember, I'm also taking that from memory, but it's the id, the ego, and the superego. And, of course, the ego and the superego go into this idea of the conscious, unconscious. From the scriptures, especially Hebrews 4:12, it says the word of God is like a double-edged sword cutting between the division of soul and spirit. Basically, there is a division. And it kind of says like there's a division of bone and marrow. Now, obviously, bone and marrow are intimately linked, yet we can still make a distinction. So the soul and the spirit are very intimately linked, and yet we can see the division. The soul is your identity. It's the I. Okay? And the way I usually think of this is kind of like the old Tom and Jerry cartoon, where the cartoon character has an angel that looks like them that pops up and says, "You shouldn't do wrong." And then on the other shoulder, they have a devil. And the devil says, "No, do what you want to do." And then the person in between the two makes the decision. So the soul will be that individual that makes the decision. The soul is the will. And typically we go with the idea of mind, will, and emotions. The spirit incorporates a lot of our subconscious and incorporates life force. And I believe that this order of body, soul, and spirit, we're not quite in the same alignment before Adam and Eve fell into sin in the Garden of Eden. You see, Adam and Eve were without what we have today, and that is what we call a sinful nature, the flesh. How did that work? Well, the spirit, that spiritual life force, was connected to God, and it was the authority over the person. And so the spirit would communicate the will of God, and the soul would listen, and the flesh would then listen to the immaterial. Well, what happened? Basically, the souls of Adam and Eve were not necessarily enslaved to the spirit. And so they refused temptation. And when they refused they no longer were spiritual, and their spirits had died. And that's why in the Bible it talks about how the day you eat of it, you will be dead, because they died in their spirit. Now, once they died in their spirit, their body would take on a process of death. They didn't die right then physically, but they spiritually died. They were not in favor of the spirit, and so they were not going to listen to the spirit. And so in the courtroom of your soul, you are a judge, and your flesh is, let's say, a prosecution of types, but the lawyer, the defendant, has no activity. The defendant is dead. And so you have to things out, and your flesh will tell you, hey, go with me, hey, go with me, hey, go with me. Meanwhile, your spirit has nothing to say. I believe that man is spiritually dead. But I believe there is some activity. Unfortunately, it's not enough to have understanding. So when mankind looks at the realm of the spirit, it is a vast mystery. And religion is a vast mystery. And we see, quote unquote, the light, but we don't really see what the light is. And so religious people will try to work with that. But it is so easy to confuse. And so you have two different characters in society. You have the atheist type and you have the religious type. And the atheist type goes with simple science and logic. The problem is that you do not have objective logic. Even with an atheistic worldview, you have to deal with the fact that your brain can have misfires, that you are a bunch of chemicals, and that your brain is in a stage of evolution. So at the end of the day, you have no objectivity. Your logic might not be pure logic. And don't get me started on your observations. Because ultimately, everything that you have and you do and you think is in a world that we call subjective. And so every activity that we do is chaotic. We're just hitting some general ideas and concepts, and then we hit and we miss. But we can make major life-changing decisions in that state of chaos. Meanwhile, you have this religious world. You have this form of spirituality, but you don't know where you're really at. You know, not only is there a God, but the question is there a devil? So this is the nature of man prior to what we call regeneration, or being born again and given spiritual life. But man's nature, because he is spiritually dead, is not good. Man was created with this image of God that does give us dignity, that does give us reason, that was designed to do good. And yet, we internally are flawed and corrupted. And this corruption will work itself out into ourselves physically. And so, man has fallen into sin. And slowly but surely, humanity gets worse and worse in this compound. God has brought different things to bear, different tools to help. And one of these things is the law. The law is objective and true. Now, the law is not created to redeem man, but is created to have an ultimatum. It is made to show us death. It says, I have set before you death and life. Choose life that you may live. Deuteronomy 30. And so with the law, we have the first four laws that tell us about good. Well, hold on. No, they all tell us about good. Sorry. We have these first four laws that relate to God. Why is it essential that we have these four laws that relate to God? Because if you do not relate to God, then you cannot relate to righteousness and morality. You see, without God, there is no objectivity. And when there is no objectivity, then what we do can be in total opposition to one another. And so people divide, and our nation is much more divided as it has marched towards what we call ungodliness. Racism is much stronger right now than when we were having a revival not long after 9/11. A lot of issues pop up that used to not pop up. Sexism, different things like that. And people have all these different self-interests that are not looking for an objective good, but just a subjective good. But your subjective good is not 100% good. So let's say you are pro-woman, and that's all you are. Well, then what about the rest of you? The rest of you is immoral because you're not looking for objective truth. Now, when we look at society, Israel understood the law of the Ten Commandments, but also our culture, which started with the British culture or Saxon culture. In 900, King Alfred the Great had developed a law system. Being king, that's what his divine right was. And by the way, when we talk about divine rights, some of these systems developed by nature. And the Old Testament often will adjust to man's will. Adam was made to dominate the earth, have dominion over the earth, and have dominion and freedom. And so his children would also be focused in that way of dominion and freedom, specifically the males. But there was a curse of sin. And this curse of sin would give more and more limitations. Adam had all of nature working for him as his servant. All the animal kingdom would do anything he wanted. But this was no longer the case after the fall. And so he would have to domesticate some of them in order to get some of them to work for him. Some animals are just wild, period. And Adam would have to work by the sweat of his brow and return to the dust, return to death. Now, later on, the patriarchs would then try to do what they could to labor and to release all their responsibility to labor. So what did they do? Well, the first thing they did is they had as many kids as they could. But there was a limit on how many kids a woman was going to have. So what do you do? Well, let's marry more women. So then they would marry multiple wives, polygamy. And they would have many children. And what were they doing? They were creating more slaves to do more work so that they could get some relief. And then they started binding other people. And so they would find somebody who was down on their luck, and they would make them slaves and say, look, I'll feed you and take care of you, but you got to work for me from here on out. So slavery got started. And then finally, these men would become heads of big families, then heads of tribes, and then eventually heads of nations. And you would have kings. And they would have total power, because ultimately they were like super fathers, and the father enslaved his children. And everyone would listen to the father for the answer. So they would listen to the king for the answer. And the king would determine the language. And the king would determine the philosophy. And the king would determine the politic. And the king would determine the religion. And that is how the ancients ruled and controlled things. But ultimately, men need dominion. So these things would not work out well. In fact, it would even get more grotesque over time. For instance, if a man is dominating a culture like this, he might not want competition. So he takes the other men and they castrate them. They would cut off their groins and their penises just so they couldn't reproduce, so that the king would be the ultimate progenitor. And basically, hopefully, effeminize these men and make them slaves. They called them eunuchs. And these quests for power would get worse and worse, and you would have these tyrants and killers and murderers and everything else. Why? Because the nature of man had lost morality, and the law was becoming tyrannical. So we see this process, and the need for freedom, which is an outgrowth of the dominion nature, would be through democracy and then through capitalism. And so these things would naturally grow out from that. But King Alfred the Great instituted Saxon law, and Saxon law did something different. It respected others. And why did it do that? Because Alfred the Great was a convert to Christianity. And in his conversion, he set up the law according to the law of Moses. He set up the Ten Commandments and other passages. And over the centuries, two things happened. One is that the kingdoms would be united, and there would be a system of justice that would dominate. And this system of justice that would dominate the British people was British common law. And that common law worked out through a series of court cases over 6 or 7 centuries, was in line with the basic foundations of Mosaic law. That was British common law, and it turned into American common law. And this is where we had this idea of justice having equality. Now, that doesn't guarantee equality in other fields of life, but it was justice that has equality. Now, when we deal with morals, I think we'll kind of go on a little bit, but basically, when we deal with morality, our culture has no concept of morality, which means they have no concept of justice. And that is why it's almost guaranteed, if our culture remains in this atheistic secular trend, and I know it's not just atheism, there's a lot of New Age and materialism that might be even stronger than the atheism itself. But in this general rule of political correctness, we still are seeing this evolutionary atheistic foundation. Okay, when we deal with socialism, socialism is based on Marxism. It's based in this evolutionary worldview. It's based in this naturalistic atheistic worldview. So this is still affecting things, even though you don't have to necessarily be an atheist to support that. Nevertheless, sexual nature has been eliminated, and all our sexual laws are slowly degrading. And so the cost is human life through abortion. The cost is also human freedom through sex slavery. You see, prostitution is a form of slavery. the woman surrenders her body to the will of another. She may not like what's going on, but she is ransomed for money. And sometimes she's even forced. And this is what we see with human trafficking. As we've allowed for prostitution, we've also allowed for human trafficking. And we're allowing for kidnapping, and we're allowing for child molestation into the culture in order to justify the original premise to destroy all sexual law. You see, it's an interwoven thread. And if you set fire to one thread in a blanket, it spreads the whole blanket. And so it's not just, well, how do I treat a homosexual? Or can a homosexual couple be married and accepted? It is, how can we destroy all sexual morality? And that is what was the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah. It wasn't just a few people have weird feelings about people of the same sex. No, it was the destruction of all sexual law. And so a group of men wanted to rape an angel, thinking it was a man. Or maybe perhaps thinking it was an angel. That's a debatable point. But yet, this need for dominion will ultimately destroy the rights of others. Why? Because of the psychology of it. You see, it's not that man is only a rational creature. Man has reason. And you want man to work with reason. But humans are not just rational. And so what happens is that as you encourage certain behavior, then other behaviors follow along. When we deal with drug abuse, right now there's such a massive push, and it's sad for me to say this, but it's not only Democrats now. It's also conservatives through libertarianism. And the idea is that, hey, we should not impose our morals in order for there to be freedom. Okay? And what happens is that you make legislation, but you've also encouraged immorality. And the problem is that when we introduce the idea of I can take a substance to get high, recreational use of drugs, then what we are actually doing is we are giving a psychological incentive for intoxication and addiction. And these intoxications and addictions are immoral, and they attract greater immorality, especially because there is a spiritual world. And since there is a spiritual world, we know that there are angels that are fallen. We call them demons. And so as these people get into addiction, they become demonically possessed. And people talk in terms to keep away from any of the spiritual mention. They don't want to say it's evil. They don't want to say it's demonic. But that's what we see when we see these massive waves of crime. You see, we're not upholding spiritual goodness. We're not being a force for the angelic. We are being a force for the demonic. And so as these things grow in our immoral behavior, there is an immoral spiritual realm that is growing stronger and causing more sin, which leads to physical death. Now, what happens is they try to psychologize this, because psychology is a secular dealing of the soul. The soul? Yes, psyche. The Greek word psyche is soul. Psychology, the logic of the soul. It is an alternative religion. Ultimately, Damien argues that this is so soft a science that it's not a science at all. And I'm not saying it doesn't have any truth, but the truth revealed in Scripture is authoritative, especially especially over the spiritual realm. The spiritual book has an expertise on the spiritual realm. The materialistic discipline does not, by any means. And so they talk about psychologists, and then you see mass shooters. Okay? You know, you had a woman who was a psychologist, and her son, who had mental problems, apparently kills her and goes off and kills children in the elementary school. Going on. Apparently, the psychology is not an antidote to what we call evil. And so these are the things of human nature that we have to understand if we're to understand the nature of justice and the nature of society. Because this is reality. And this is where we have failed. We have failed to assert what reality really is. And it's not because you believe it and you feel good about it, but you believe it meaning you recognize that this is the truth, this is the reality, and these are the presuppositions you need to conduct justice, to have law. Because without morality and knowledge of truth, there is no law. And society crumbles, and that is what we are seeing. We are seeing society crumble because we have gotten rid of God. Stay tuned for the next lecture, and we'll catch you later on Kentuckiana Grassroots Radio.